The Zelensky experiment is over. I think even the Germans are getting tired of Zelensky. Europe is just a bunch of unruly children. Where is the adult in Europe today? Neutrality makes Switzerland a great nation, not just a great nation, one of the greatest nations. This is the new Russia. This is Vladimir Putin. He is the greatest leader in the history of Russia.
Grüezi miteinander, ganz herzlich willkommen und einen wunderschönen guten Tag, meine sehr verehrten Damen und Herren, liebe Freunde aus nah und fern, von wo aus auch immer Sie uns zuschauen mögen. Ich freue mich sehr, Sie zu begrüßen zu einer wirklich sehr speziellen Spezialausgabe von Weltwoche Daily, die andere Sicht, unabhängig, kritisch, gut gelaunt, aufgezeichnet am Donnerstag, dem 27. September 2023. Aber das, was Sie im Folgenden sehen werden, in aller Ausführlichkeit, hat Bestand über den Tag hinaus. Weltwoche Daily ist ja vom Weltwochegeist geprägt. Nonkonformismus, Gegensteuer geben, die Demokratie, die Vielfalt, die Meinungsvielfalt verteidigen und eben nicht die Einfalt mitmachen, diesen Gleichschritt, den wir leider allzu oft im allgemeinen Konformismus, im sogenannten Mainstream erleben, erdulden und erleiden müssen. Wir bringen immer wieder auch die Stimmen, die Sie sonst nicht hören können, jene Akzente, jene Argumente, jene Kontrapunkte, die Ihnen erlauben sollen, ein differenzierteres Bild zu gewinnen und auch eben die Gegenseite zu hören, die andere Sicht, die es immer gibt. Und die andere Sicht ist die Voraussetzung für jede Erkenntnis, für jedes Gespräch, für jeden Dialog. Und darum ist das so wichtig. Und die Weltwoche macht das seit ihrer Gründung vor bald 90 Jahren, unkonventioneller Journalismus. Und das Thema der heutigen Sendung ist die Weltlage, ist die Außenpolitik, ist der Ukraine-Krieg. Und es ist uns gelungen, einen sehr distinguierten Gast hier zu gewinnen für ein wirklich ausführliches Gespräch. Es ist der amerikanische Kommentator, der frühere Nachrichtenoffizier und UNO-Waffeninspektor Scott Ritter. Scott Ritter, mittlerweile 62 Jahre alt, blickt auf eine sehr lange Karriere in den amerikanischen Sicherheitsapparaten zurück. Er hat den ersten Golfkrieg erlebt. Er hat als Waffeninspektor das Abgleiten der Vereinigten Staaten in den verheerenden zweiten Irakkrieg erlebt. Das war für ihn ein Damaskus-Erlebnis, wie er mir erzählt hat. Da habe er seine Beurteilung, seine Auffassung der amerikanischen Außenpolitik verändert. Und nun tritt er seit über einem Jahr hervor als prononcierter Kritiker der amerikanischen Politik gegenüber Russland in der Ukraine, und er beurteilt die Lage aus einer fundierten Kenntnis auch der Geschichte und aus der persönlichen Erfahrung heraus, die er natürlich im Gespräch und in seinen früheren Tätigkeiten gewonnen hat. Scott Ritter, auch ein Buchautor, ein Vortragsredner, der war kürzlich sogar in der Schweiz, hat da an einer Veranstaltung einer Stiftung einen Vortrag gehalten und, wie er mir ebenfalls erklärte, sehr viel gelernt über die schweizerische Neutralität. Wir haben ein langes, ein ausführliches Gespräch geführt über diesen Krieg und wesentliche Akzente, wesentliche Thesen und Befunde von ihm lauten: Erstens, die Russen haben diesen Krieg in der Ukraine faktisch bereits gewonnen. Der Westen hat verloren, weigert sich allerdings noch, dieser Tatsache ins Auge zu blicken. Die europäische Politik sei mehr oder weniger inexistent. Es gebe keine Erwachsenen im Raum. Die einzigen Erwachsenen, die er auf der Weltbühne erblickt, die herausragenden Führungspersönlichkeiten, abgesehen von allen ihren Schwächen und Abgründen und auch Dingen, die uns nicht an ihnen gefallen mögen, sind nach Aussage von Scott Ritter Wladimir Putin und Xi Jinping. bin. Sehr interessant, was er über die Entwicklung der amerikanischen Außenpolitik zu erzählen weiß. Und am Schluss reden wir natürlich auch noch über die Schweiz, über die Neutralität. Und da werden Sie ein flammendes Plädoyer hören, sehr gut, brillant formuliert von Scott Ritter. Eine glühende Verteidigungsrede der schweizerischen Neutralität. Er sagt, Schweizer bleibt neutral, denn die Neutralität ist die Grundlage der Größe und des Ansehens eures Landes. Wenn ihr euch bei der NATO anschleicht, wenn ihr da mitmacht oder passiv Mitglied werdet, dann verkleinert ihr euch. Und es ist für ihn unverständlich, dass heutige Schweizer Politiker den Wert der Neutralität nicht mehr zu erkennen bereit oder in der Lage sind. Dies ein paar skizzenhaft hingeworfene Thesen von Scott Ritter. Aber hören Sie selbst, schauen Sie selbst eine ausführliche Konversation über die Weltlage. Wir durchmessen düsterste Abgründe, aber ich kann Ihnen versprechen, am Ende selbstverständlich kommt der große Lichtblick. Zwei Optimisten im Gespräch, ohne allerdings die Lage heute sich irgendwie schönreden zu wollen. Würde mich freuen, wenn Sie sich darauf einlassen. Bühne frei für Scott Ritter. Vielen herzlichen Dank schon jetzt für Ihre Aufmerksamkeit und für Ihre Bemerkungen und auch vielleicht kritischen, welcher Art auch immer, würde mich sehr freuen, auch von Ihnen da ein Echo zu erhalten. Aber jetzt genug der Vorrede, unser Interview mit dem amerikanischen Militär-, Sicherheits- und Waffenexperten Scott Ritter.
Welcome to Weltwoche Daily Special. Welcome to this interview.
Well, thank you very much for having me.
Where are you now? Are you in the United States now, or are, from where are you transmitting?
I am transmitting from my home studio in Del Mar, New York. That's upstate New York, just outside of the state capital of Albany.
Great. Just to start it off, could you quickly introduce yourself to give our viewers and readers an impression that they can, you know, have a picture of yourself?
Well, I've been around for 62 years, so there's a little bit of history here. I was raised as a child of a career Air Force officer. So I grew up around the world. I went to three different high schools, one in Hawaii, one in Turkey. I graduated from an American high school in Kaiserslautern, Germany. I enlisted in the Army after graduation because I think being from a military background, given the fact that it was the Cold War, the fact that I graduated from a high school in Germany right across the border was the Soviet threat. I felt a desire, a need to serve my country. And I left the Army, went to college, got my degree in Russian history, and then was commissioned as an officer in the Marines. I went into the intelligence field. I served in combat arms units, training to fight the Soviet threat. In 1987, Ronald Reagan and Mikhail Gorbachev signed the Intermediate Nuclear Forces Treaty to get rid of entire classes of nuclear weapons. The Department of Defense was tasked with creating an inspection agency to go in and implement this treaty. And the Marine Corps was tasked with providing officers who spoke Russian and knew something about Russia. But they also wanted people who had the rank of major or lieutenant colonel. I was a lieutenant at the time. But the database showed that they didn't have anybody. I got selected for the job. And so as a junior lieutenant, I was sent off to the Soviet Union to implement arms control treaties. I did a very good job. I have to say that I enjoyed the work. I was successful at it. Got a couple classified commendations from the director of the CIA. The Marine Corps viewed my work with great importance. And when I left that job, I went back to the Marine Corps right in time for Saddam Hussein to invade Kuwait. And I got caught up in the war. I ended up serving on General Schwarzkopf's staff in Riyadh, where because of my background as a weapons inspector, a missile inspector, I was put in, I was given the task of trying to hunt down Iraqi Scud missiles that were firing into Israel and in the Arabian Peninsula. And that became my focus during the war. I worked with a variety of units, special forces unit, air force units, etc. The war ended. At that time, I made a decision that my future would probably not be with the Marine Corps. The Cold War was over. I joined to kill Russians, and we weren't in the Russian killing business anymore. So I was going to get out and pursue civilian life. But I was called by the United Nations. Some of the officers whom I worked for as a weapons inspector were now tasked with implementing the Security Council resolutions calling for the disarmament of Iraq. They were having trouble with the Iraqis. The Iraqis were lying. They weren't turning over what they should. And there was a need to create an intelligence organization within this inspection unit. And I was asked to come in and do this, to build an intelligence organization. I did that. The job took on a life of its own. I became not just an intelligence collector or an assessor, but I became an inspector, an operator. I ran sort of a full service entity to collect information, evaluate it, inspect, come back. I did that for 7 years, leading some of the most controversial and confrontational inspections against the Iraqis. I resigned from my position in 1998, citing American interference in the work of the inspectors. And then from that point on, I became critical of American policy leading up to the 2003 decision to invade Iraq. I publicly made the case that there were no weapons of mass destruction left in Iraq worthy of an invasion, that Iraq had been fundamentally disarmed by the teams that I was involved in. We went to war anyways. I was proven to be correct. And then ever since then, I've been I've taken it upon myself to criticize U.S. policy where it needs to be criticized. I'm a very loyal American, patriotic American. I think I've shown I'm willing to die for my country. But the key aspect of being an American is to recognize what you're serving. You don't serve a president. You don't serve a government. You serve the people. And the people is best served by adherence to the Constitution of the United States of America. And when we have governments that implement policies that deviate from the principles, the values of the letter of the law, then it's the duty and responsibility of a patriotic American to speak out. And so that's what I do today. I speak out where needed. And right now, my focus of effort is on the ongoing conflict between Russia and Ukraine, where I find American policy to be sadly wanting.
What is the most important thing you have learned throughout your career, your experiences in on the battlefield and as a UN inspector, intelligence officer? What is the most important thing you have learned about international conflicts and diplomacy? What's the sum of your...
Some of my knowledge.
Yeah.
That war should be the absolute last resort. That wars rarely achieve what they set out to achieve. They always result in death and destruction, and they always result in a situation that's worse coming out than it was going in. That the best option for the endeavors of nations are to prevent wars through diplomacy, that we should invest money in diplomacy, and we should be honest about diplomacy, meaning that right now, sometimes I believe that diplomatic tools are used to facilitate warfare, to set up the conditions for war, as opposed to ensuring that the conditions for war never exist. And so I believe that diplomacy must be given a chance, but it has to be honest diplomacy. I think I've also learned that my country is the number one problem in the world today. The way my country interfaces with the rest of the world, we interface as a singular hegemon, where we insist that the world revolve around an exceptional America. And I've learned that there's no such thing as American exceptionalism, that the rest of the world has a vote. The rest of the world is populated by human beings who have shared values. Every human has shared values. We want to live. We want things good for our kids. We want a better future. And that future should be a future that's shrouded by peace, not war. And so, you know, that's it. Diplomacy, and that America needs to do a better job of being diplomatic.
Mm-hmm. How close are we now to a Third World War, looking at the situation in the Ukraine?
You know, the Ukrainian conflict, as it is being won by Russia. And that's a problem for the United States and Europe, because we've been setting up this conflict for decades now with the intent of defeating Russia. And Russia's upended that entire calculus, which means that the entire national security and foreign policy strategies of the United States, NATO, Europe are no longer valid. And when you invalidate national security visions on this scope and scale, you create a feeling of existential risk. And right now we have a situation in the United States and Europe that perceives a Russian victory in Ukraine as being a threat of existential proportions. And there is active talk about, the need to use nuclear weapons. The Russians, on the other hand, aren't going to use nuclear weapons preemptively, but have said that if nuclear weapons are used against them, that they will respond with the totality of their capabilities, which would mean general nuclear war, the end of the world. The fact that we have the United States reflecting on what opportunities could exist for the use of nuclear weapons at a time when the Russians have said, if you use nuclear weapons, we will kill everything, means that we are in a very dangerous situation. I say that this, some people say that this is the worst it's been since the Cuban Missile Crisis. I say it's worse than the Cuban Missile Crisis, because the Cuban Missile Crisis was a controlled crisis. Both parties knew what they were getting into going in. The Soviets wanted American Jupiter missiles out of Turkey and Italy, and the Americans wanted Soviet SS-4 and SS-5 missiles out of Cuba. And there was a quid pro quo arrangement, even though the American withdrawal of missiles was kept secret. It was controlled crisis. It was dangerous, don't get me wrong, but it was controlled. There was an end game that both parties could agree to. Right now, we have an uncontrolled crisis with an end game that both parties don't agree to. The United States and Europe are not in a position at this point in time to accept the reality of a Russian victory. And so, until these nations, the collective West, so to speak, is able to understand that the reality is Russia has won, and to comprehend what that means and then adapt accordingly, if they're going to struggle against the inevitability of a Russian victory at a time when nuclear weapons become the only last remaining weapon to prevent this, we're in danger of there being a nuclear war, especially when the strategists in the United States and Europe openly talk about a limited nuclear war, tactical nuclear weapons. We can escalate to de-escalate. This is all nonsense. There's no such thing as a limited nuclear war. A tactical nuclear weapon will lead inevitably to the release of strategic nuclear weapons, which will in turn lead to the destruction of the planet.
Why are you saying Russia has won this war? If I look at our media in Switzerland, in Germany, I get a totally different picture. The journalists are writing, well, there are some difficulties in the Ukraine offensive. The former British Prime Minister has just written a great essay after his travels to Kiev, saying that the Ukraine can still win this war. We have to move up our assistance. We have to send even more weapons. In Germany, the Chancellor is thinking about sending these bunker-breaking missiles. How do you come to the conclusion that Russia has won this war? And why do our media and politicians continue to say the opposite?
Well, I can answer the second part first. Your media and your politicians are lying, and they know they're lying. Straight up know they're lying. A former British Prime Minister writing this essay, he wrote it for political effect, not because he's telling the truth. He's a liar. And I would tell any one of your reporters to their face, they're liars. And if they challenge me, I'll say, I'll tell you what, come with me. The next time Germany provides a shipment of modern weaponry to Ukraine, come with me. Let's get on one of those tanks. Let's ride it to the front and let's join the victorious Ukrainian army that you write so, because clearly you interact with them. You've been to the front line, right? You've been in the leading element of the attack. You've seen this great Ukrainian victory. Ride with me to victory. Let's go. None of them will do it because they all know what the result will be. They'll be dead before they get there because that's the reality. Every one of your reporters are liars. Every one of their editors are liars. And again, please sue me. Sue me for defamation. I will take you to court. I will insist on full disclosure, and you will go down in flames because you're liars, every one of you. Any word you write is true. Is the Russians are prevailing on the battlefield. They're slaughtering the Ukrainians. This is why your reporters won't go to the front line, because mm-hmm. they'll be dead reporters. Mm-hmm. This is the statement of fact. The Russians have defeated the Ukrainian army. Mm-hmm. They provide bunker-busting missiles. Is this a new concept? Did Germany invent bunker-busting missiles? I'm just curious, because I imagine the Russians have never heard of bunker-busting missiles. So therefore, when they're used by the Ukrainians against the Russians, this will be a miracle weapon that will cause the Russians to panic and surrender and the war will be over. Or is this missile actually well known to everybody? It's been around. It has a limited utility. It will kill some Russians, but the end result will be nothing. Because in war, people die. Weapons kill people. This is not a miracle weapon. Didn't the Germans learn about that? Didn't you believe at one point in time that the V1 and V2 were miracle weapons, that if you use them against the British, they would surrender? How'd that work out for you? It didn't work out very well. None of your weapons are miracle weapons. There's no such thing as a miracle weapon. What is a miracle are the troops in the weapons. They make the weapons work. And right now, the Russian troops are 10 times better than the Ukrainian troops, not because the Ukrainian troops don't have heart or courage, but how can you man these miracle weapons provided by the West when you have 21 days basic training and maybe 5 more weeks of advanced training? What does it take to train a German soldier? I imagine it's more than 21 days. And if you have a German soldier involved in complex combined arms warfare, I would imagine it would take about 1.5 to 2 years to train that soldier. Why does Germany believe that the Ukrainian soldiers can do 2.5 months what it takes the Germans 2 years to accomplish in terms of training? This is why Ukraine's losing the war, because Germans have caused their defeat. British have caused their defeat. Americans have caused their defeat because we're asking them to do something they literally cannot do. How long does it take to train a Leopard tank operator to be competent in all aspects of tactical warfare? A heck of a lot longer than the Ukrainian forces were trained on them. And yet you're asking them to take this tank and lead it in to a combat assault breaching operation, the most complex form of offensive military action ever, without the training, the experience, or the familiarity with the equipment. Shame on Germany. Shame on Europe. Shame on America. You're responsible for the deaths of 500,000 Ukrainian men. I hope everybody hangs their head in shame when that awful reality sets in on them.
And what do you think about the following statement? I've read it, and I'm sure you know it. Skeptics, people have a similar view as you. They say the West will never allow the Ukraine to lose this war. That means they cannot accept a Russian victory because they have invested so much capital, political capital, financial capital, the United States, the whole government has supported it. We have elections. I mean, what's going to happen on this front? Will the West continue in spite of this, according to you, victory of the Russians? Will they just not let happen? Will they just not let this defeat happen? Will they somehow, what will they do?
Well, let's start off by noting this. In the year leading up to the defeat in Afghanistan, remember that one? America got beat. NATO got beat. Germany got beat, too. Everybody got beat by the Taliban, of all people. But we were told, we will never allow the Taliban to win. It will never happen. We've spent billions. We've invested everything. Victory, 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 victory. Same thing's going to happen in Ukraine. Because let me ask question and response. What can NATO and Europe do? I mean, to say we can't allow the Russians to win, what can you do to prevent that? Are you going to sanction Russia more? How's that working out, Germany? It's your economy that's in free fall. Deindustrialization has gripped your economy. It's your people who've lost the energy subsidy this winter because your government's bankrupt. How did sanctions work out for Germany? I can tell you how they worked out for Russia because I just came back from Russia. 26 days, 12 cities. The Russian economy is booming. booming. They ain't going to be cold this winter. Their refrigerators aren't going to be empty. They're going to be doing A-OK. Why? Because sanctions don't work. They've backfired on Germany, on Europe. So what is Germany going to do? Sanction Russia some more. Please. I think the Russians are begging you to. Because apparently every time you sanction Russia, they get stronger, you get weaker. So we know that sanctions don't work. Political isolation, because Germany has taken the moral high ground here. And the world is rallying behind Germany to say, you are right. The Russians are wrong. We are with you, Germany. Or is it that everybody's looking at saying, hey, did you guys do this once before? I remember a couple of decades ago, you strapped on some uniforms. You rode in big tanks that had funny cat-like names. I don't know, Panther, Tiger. You rode them east towards Russia. And you fought in Ukrainian fields before. And you got beat. And outside of the Reichstag today, I believe there's monuments that have T-34-85 tanks on them that are symbolic of the Soviet army coming in and destroying the Nazi regime. And so, haven't you learned anything? I mean, I believe there's a graveyard in Germany that contains the body, the last mortal remains of Stepan Bandera. Mm-hmm. You know who he is. He's a Nazi-supporting thug who murdered tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands of people. His supporters did. He fled to Germany and was brought under the wing of the German intelligence service, which was really nothing more than an extension of the Galen organization, which was a Nazi intelligence organization that ran the Banderas in Ukraine when the Nazis were there. But now they've been reanointed and they've been told, you're okay. I think the ugly truth is that Germany's never really shed itself of its Nazi past, because if it had, Germans wouldn't be so willing to see German tanks with another cat name going to battle in Ukraine against the Russians. Germans should be hanging their head in shame, saying, no, we're not going to do this. What is Germany going to do? Mobilize the German army. What German army? Mm-hmm. That's in all sincerity, what German army? Mm-hmm. Is there anything to be mobilized? My understanding is that the Germans, to get a tank battalion reinforced, sent up to be part of the NATO battle group in Lithuania. Again, the idea of German tanks in Lithuania should make people sick to their stomachs. But today the Germans are going, that's normal. It's not normal, by the way, to have German tanks in Lithuania. Bad thing, bad look, bad history. But you had to scrap and cannibalize all your other units to make that happen. Now there's talk about Germany rebuilding its military, 100 billion euro to make the new strong German armies to do what? March through Poland to fight Russians. Didn't you do that before already? You got beat. You're going to get beat again if you try, but you're not going to be able to do it, because in order to do that, you have to have an industrial base. My understanding is that your companies are shutting down because they can't afford to keep working because of high energy costs. You're deindustrializing. Unemployment, etc. Oh, yeah, that $100 billion or euro military, you're not going to be able to do it. Mm-hmm. I think the German government has come back and quietly told NATO, we can't do the 2% GDP thing you want us to do because we're bankrupt. We have no money. We got nothing. So I come back to you, Germany and NATO and the United States. So you keep saying you can't accept a Russian victory, but you have no option but to accept it. Because you've lost, you've been beat, you're not going to win. The Russians are, and there's nothing you can do about it. Nothing you can do about it.
So what do you think? How will this now play out in the next few months? Will we see then a formal armistice or some kind of negotiations? Or what is your expectation for the near future? What will happen?
Well, I can't put I'm hesitant to put a timeline on it because the Russians don't put a timeline on it. They're objective driven. The war will end when Russia wins the war. Mm-hmm. That's it. And that's the difference, you see, because in Germany, everybody's going, right, can we be done by this point? If we give them assistance here, we can be finished by the spring. Do we have to fund it to 20? The Russians are saying that people go, well, Russia, when's the war going to end? When we win. When's that going to be? When we win. But I mean, when we win. That's it. That's the difference. The Russians will win because that's their objective. Everybody else is putting artificial calendar-driven things. But the fact of the matter is, the war ends when two things happen. One, the Ukrainian army no longer is capable of fighting in a coherent fashion, and they're rapidly approaching that point right now. Their last strategic reserves have been expended. they're getting 31 M1 Abrams tanks. I think the Russians are ready to surrender right now. The fact is, I'm pretty sure Vladimir Putin just called up Joe Biden and said, 31 M1 tanks? When can we sit down and negotiate the terms of our surrender? I'm ready to give up today because it's 31 M1 tanks. You've never heard of the M1 before. It's a miracle weapon. No, it's not. It's been around forever. Old tank. It's not very good. The armor that they put on it isn't even good armor. It's the butter armor. The Russian munitions are going to cut through it like a hot knife through butter and kill everybody inside, which, again, is something that everybody tends to forget, that when these weapons fail in combat, it usually results in dead Ukrainian soldiers. But the Russians aren't worried about any of this. The Russians are going to defeat the Ukrainian army strategically. That point is coming. But the war won't end until there's a political resolution. The Russians have made it clear that Ukraine will never join NATO. So as long as there's a Ukrainian government that says we are going to join NATO, that means that the war ends when that Ukrainian government is kaput, finished, gone. We're getting close to that today. The Zelensky experiment is over. Poland has said no. I think even the Germans are getting tired of Zelensky. His wife, I don't know if you saw the 60 Minutes interview that she gave just recently, an exhausted woman who talked about the political future, saying he's not certain that the Ukrainian people will continue to want Zelensky to be their president in upcoming elections. Now, I've seen a lot of politicians' spouses when they're interviewed on the verge of an election campaign. They're all upbeat. My husband's going to win. He's great. The people love him. She was all defeated. The Zelensky era is over. He's doomed. He's collapsing as we speak. And when he collapses, that which replaces him will probably be inclined to bring an end to this war. This war, if there is a negotiation, the negotiation resemble what occurred on the deck of the USS Missouri, a battleship in Tokyo Bay on September 2nd, 1945, where the Japanese were brought in, stood before a table, and compelled to sign a surrender document without conditions. It was unconditional surrender. And that's the future for Ukraine. At some point in time, a Ukrainian official will appear before a Russian delegation, documents will be on the table, and they'll be handed a pen. They'll be told, sign, document, it's over. And they will have no say in what's in that document because they have been defeated strategically. That's the reality. The day and age of negotiation has passed. I remind your audience that in March of 2022, the Russians had engaged in extensive negotiation with the Ukrainians, and they had a peace plan in hand, initialed by everybody. And it was ready to be finalized on 1 April in Istanbul. And it was NATO, through that same British prime minister who wrote that wonderful article talking about the need to continue. Yes, Boris Johnson. He's the guy that flew in and said, no, don't do peace because NATO's behind you. We're going to back you. How does that work out? The day of negotiations over, the Russians will not negotiate. There will be no ceasefire. There will be no frozen conflict. The war is over. Europe, you lost. Get used to it.
What do you think is the game plan of the American government, of this American government? I mean, it's puzzling. I'm not against the United States. You are not against the United States, but probably we both are very skeptical and critical about the direction of the American foreign policy, let's say, till 1990, after they won the Cold War, basically. What's your explanation that the United States have created this situation where Russia was somehow provoked into this war? I mean, is that serious foreign policy? Is this Zbigniew Brzezinski, the great chessboard kind of geopolitical maneuvering, or is this kind of shallow idealism? Is it not clear-cut thinking? What's your explanation of the American strategy towards Russia, and how will it play out now? Will the Americans just change course? Will they sooner or later admit we've lost? Okay, let's run off, or let's call it off, as we did in Afghanistan, as we did with Georgia. Please explain to us the United States of America.
Well, I would say that we started off as reluctant superpowers. if you take a look at, Theodore Roosevelt was the first American president that sought a global presence.
Rough Rider.
The Rough Rider. And I love Theodore Roosevelt, but, you know, he built the big American fleet and it sailed around the world. And, you know, but his philosophy was speak softly and carry a big stick, meaning we're not here to yell at you or anything. But if you want to mess with us, we'll beat you over the head because we're America, beginning of American sea power. World War One came. Wilson got America involved in that war on the side of Great Britain, an empire against the Germans, an empire. You know, a lot of Americans believe we fought for the wrong side at that time, but it doesn't matter. We did what we did. But we emerged from that with a feeling of, so Europe was exhausted by conflict. And the United States was this power that suddenly had, it was still a young power, an immature power, but, we were flexing our muscles. We suddenly realized, hey, we're pretty strong. We got some muscles. You guys are a bunch of old men who were all beat up after this war. League of Nations, we talked about, values and all this stuff, but it didn't quite work. The world wasn't ready for that. And America went into a period of isolationism leading up to the Second World War. We were strong economically, but we didn't want to get involved in this global war stuff. That was your business. The Japanese and the Chinese was their business. Europe was your business.
It was not the Swiss business. It was not the Swiss business. We stayed out of all the wars. Of course.
Or what we can say is it was all your business.
Meaning, it was forced upon us. It was forced upon us. Of our neighbors was forced upon us.
And you gladly assisted in the banking operations to help this. But
here I had to intervene fiercely, but I don't want to interrupt you. Please continue.
No. First of all, I'm saying that with a smile on my face because I'm not an expert.
Sure. Otherwise, I would have just called my lawyer. I would have just called my lawyer and my two bodyguards. But of course, you smile, save the situation.
Thank you. You have two bodyguards. You might need three. But
well, they're hiding now.
Okay. No, but the point is, the United States was reluctantly brought into the war. Now, President Roosevelt was more aggressive. He, of course, had Lend-Lease. He had the aggressive trolling in the Atlantic, and some people accuse him of creating the condition that facilitated a Japanese attack on Pearl Harbor. I'm not a conspiracy theorist. The Japanese attacked us because we were trying to prevent them from getting oil and things of that nature. But the point is, we were thrust into this war, a global war. And again, while we suffered casualties, while we paid a price economically in terms of lost material, etc., we were untouched. Other than Pearl Harbor getting bombed, American soil, I think we got an Aleutian island, Attu and Kiska, up there in the Aleutians in Alaska. The Japanese landed on that too. And I think a Japanese submarine launched an airplane that dropped a couple paper bombs on us. But other than that, we were untouched. Europe, meanwhile, is destroyed, devastated. Asia laid to waste. At the end of the war, America was the big power economically. And through Bretton Woods agreement, we created a system of dominance, global dominance. And we continued to do that and use that, especially as we morphed into the Cold War. You know, the Cold War didn't need to be fought. It was actually a war that was premised on Winston Churchill's prejudice against the Russians. And then Kennan being an American diplomat who wrote the long
George
telegram.
George
Kennan. He wrote a telegram that everybody misunderstood and misquoted. And he was talking about economic conflict. Everybody, people like Paul Nietzsche came in. He wrote a national security document, 68, NC 68, that became the containment strategy. But we didn't need to have a Cold War, but we did it. And one of the reasons why is that we needed an enemy. Because the American economy that had been in depression, remember, we had this horrible depression in the 1930s, and we were pulled out of that depression largely because of World War II. Now we have this powerful economy, but in order to justify these continued expenditures, we needed an enemy so we could keep the economy on a near war footing. That enemy became international communism, the Soviets, the communist Chinese. And so we create what today we call a rules-based international order to govern the world that we controlled. We had everybody tied to us economically. The dollar was the reserve currency. We called the shots. We controlled all of the World Bank and the IMF, and we controlled every. Well, I think the Swiss were trying to control it behind the scenes with their banking. I'm joking again, but we were
played some discreet part in these
discreet, yes, very discreet. But with the secret Swiss bank accounts, which I never got involved in, I too much to my regret. But maybe I'd have a.
They have to go
house.
To Delaware today for that.
Yeah, the Delaware corporations. Yeah, but again, in all seriousness, we had this massive system that was designed to defeat world communism, the Cold War, and then the Cold War ended. But what's interesting about the Cold War ending, because you talked about Brzezinski and chess. Mm-hmm. In chess and chess competitions, it's not just what happens on the board. They have a clock, you know, and so it's timed. And you can lose one of two ways. They can checkmate you or you can run out of time. Mm-hmm. And the West is like, we beat the Soviets. Checkmate. Never happened. There was never checkmate. What happened is the Soviets ran out of time.
And ran out of money.
Well, that's what I mean. I'm symbolically talking about running out of time, meaning that it wasn't a defeat of the ideology. It said it was an economic defeat, mm-hmm. Brought on by not by external pressures, but internal. The fact that the Soviet system just wasn't working, whether it's you want to call it corruption or whatever, it just wasn't working. So it collapsed. At that point in time, a true leader would have said, for instance, if you're a businessman, and you have a business model, that business model is predicated on certain realities, and then the world changes. A good businessman says, time out on our current business model. What do we have to do to adapt the current business model to the new realities? And then we will transition with these realities, and we will take a leadership role, and we'll become something different. The United States had an opportunity with the collapse of the Soviet Union to do just that, to say, time out. What are the new realities? How do we go forward from here? But instead we said, we won. We're the greatest chess players in the world. We won. So rather than change things, we're just going to try and take the system and impose it on the world. Impose the rules-based international order on the rest of the world using NATO expansion and all this stuff. And that's why we're in the situation today, because we've never been willing to change with the world. And right now, because the world has changed so much, we have no choice. We will change. Even the Biden administration, whose 2022 national security strategy document is, again, founded throughout the document in the notion that the rules-based international order is necessary for the functioning of liberal democracies around the world, and that the world is attracted to the American model of liberal democracy, and we must keep it strong. But now the Biden, I think Tony Blinken just came out and said, yeah, it looks like the rules-based international order is not as popular. People aren't buying into it. We might have to do something different. And so we're being compelled to change, and we will change. That's the reality of the United States is, we have no choice but to change. And it's going to get ugly because we're not going to change. See, if we had changed in 1991, 1992, it would have been benevolent change, meaning that we're changing for the betterment of everybody, including ourselves. Today, it's defensive change. We are in a defensive crouch because we have failed. And so as we change, we're going to be looking to hold on to what we can. And this is where Europe has to be a little nervous here, because we're going to hold on to Europe as an American colony. We're not going to call it a colony, but you're going to exist to provide an outlet for the dollar. We're going to destroy the euro, and then we're going to make Europe addicted to the dollar and the European economy tied to the dollar, tied to America. We're going to do the same in South America. We're trying to carve up our own little corner of the world while China and Russia take the rest of the world, India, etc., and Swiss banks.
Mm-hmm. Would you go so far as to say that the United States, as this victorious hegemon after the Cold War, is today a threat to world peace?
Yes, absolutely. We're the greatest threat to world peace, because the world is transitioning away from the American singularity to a multipolar reality. We see that with BRICS. We see that with the Shanghai Cooperation Organization. We see that with even the G20, which is nothing more than a tool of the G7, which is a tool of America. But even the G20 is starting to say, we want a little bit of independence. I think they'll get their independence when they dissolve the G20 and they just accept that BRICS is the thing. But it's a multipolar world taking place out there. The United States could say, we want to be part of that multipolar world, meaning, you know, but and America is so big and strong that when we walk in, the world's going to have to listen to us, not obey us, but listen to us. It's just a new way of interacting. You know, real leaders don't go in and order people to follow them. A real leader steps in the room and people say, I want to follow you. And so if America was a nation with true leadership, we would accept multipolarity and we would step into the room and people would look at us and say, I like that. I want to follow it. But not, that's not what we're doing. We're ordering people to follow us. And the world doesn't want to. We're becoming increasingly isolated in the world today. And as a result, because of our strength, we will lash out. We are the greatest threat to international peace and security, either through direct military intervention or the fact that we're running around the world and sticking our fingers in and stirring problems up, trying to weaken other people.
You have been to the Soviet Union. You have just been in Russia. You have studied as an officer, as an intelligent specialist, and I guess also as a UN inspector. You have studied the Russian leadership. You know the history of Russia. What's your assessment of Vladimir Putin? Vladimir Putin was this torchbearer of a new modernized Russia. He was the hope. He was in Germany. He got the standing ovation for his speech at the Bundestag. He was considered a man of the West, a man of St. Petersburg. And now we are reading in our newspapers, we get it from your leaders, from our leaders, that Putin is almost as bad as Hitler. He's this this walking devil on earth. He is this huge threat of autocracy, of dictatorship, and we have to destroy him in order to preserve our democracies. I mean, what's your assessment of Vladimir Putin? How, what role does he play in this international order? What are his qualities? But and what are his shortcomings, according to your perception?
I mean, that's a tall order. I'll give you an assessment. I'm not avoiding the question, but I do want to preface it by saying I've never met Vladimir Putin. I've never had the opportunity to speak with him. And it's very difficult sometimes to answer a question like the one you answered unless you can sit across from somebody, look in their eyes, look at the body language, and stuff. You can get a good assessment of somebody when you do that. So I'm doing this long distance, et cetera. So there's a little bit of a caveat here. But let me start by pointing out, before I judge Vladimir Putin as a person and as a leader, we have to talk about the times in which Putin achieved political maturity. He started out in the late 1980s. He was a KGB officer, reached the rank of lieutenant colonel. He was stationed in East Germany at the time of the fall of the Berlin Wall. He returned to St. Petersburg as part of a Soviet Union in collapse. And he left the intelligence service trying to transition in as an aide to the mayor of St. Petersburg, Sobchak. This is in the decade of the 1990s, when literally Russia is in freefall collapse. It is bad. And people who claim to be trying to help Russia are actually just trying to dismember Russia, to enrich themselves from the wealth of Russia, but take it all out of Russia, leave nothing left for Russia, to weaken Russia. This is the environment. He was not what we call a shot caller back then. A shot caller is a boss, somebody who calls the shots. Sobchak was a shot caller. Yeltsin was a shot caller. Putin worked for shot callers. You know, Sobchak had a reputation, all Russian leaders had a reputation, because you're living in a nation in decline, a society in collapse, an economy that's in tatters. So everybody's in survival mode. And what happens when you get into survival mode? The norms and standards of the niceties of a legal structure go out the window, because you can sit there and argue, well, you have to comply with paragraph 12C3A on page 42. And they're going to say, if I comply with that, I'm going to starve to death. Yes, but it's the rules. It's the law.
Yeah, but I'm going to starve to death.
Yeah. Bam! Shoot the guy with the law book, take his food, eat it. Now you're not starving to death. You're alive. Russia was in survival mode. So ugly times. And it only got worse. The best year in post-Cold War Russia was 1992. The worst year was 1999. All right? It got worse. And what's the connectivity there? Boris Yeltsin. Boris Yeltsin was a horrible leader. He wasn't democratic. No democratic leader puts tanks in the streets of Moscow to fire on the Russian parliament as he did in October of 1993. He wasn't reflective of the will of the Russian people, or else the United States wouldn't have gone in 1996 and buy an election. We bragged about it, by the way. Nice Time magazine cover, best election money can buy. He was surrounded by hugely corrupt people. The oligarch class was raised during this time by the West, by the way. We're the ones who created the oligarch class to facilitate the economic rape of Russia. Everything's falling apart. If you were a pensioner, you lost your pension. If you're somebody who had a medical need, you lost your medical care. There was very little medical care. The soldiers weren't getting paid, so the quality of the army was collapsing. Infrastructure wasn't being built because people were putting it in their pocket or taking it out. So the entire society was in collapse. That's the reality of Russia at that time. You know, I'm not going to sit here and sing the praises of Vladimir Putin. He survived the 1990s. What I will ask people is, could you have survived the 1990s? And if so, what would you have done to survive? And there's not too many Westerners that can answer that question. I'll tell you this. We have relatives. My wife has family that was in Russia at the time. They'd be dead today. Dead. That's a father, a mother, and their two children would have died if we hadn't sent them money every month to survive. Because Russia was incapable of sustaining life for many people. There's some figures out right now that talk about the number of lives lost during the 1990s, either as a direct or indirect result of the collapse of Russian society. And some of those numbers run as high as 20 million people. 20 million people died because of the collapse of Russian society. So we're talking about a nightmare scenario, apocalyptic kind. And Vladimir Putin is coming into political maturity. Now, did he cut some deals? Did he do this? Did he do that to survive? Maybe. I don't have evidence. Maybe he did. Maybe he did. Does that make him an evil person? Nope. Makes him a survivor. What I do know is this. When there were NGOs, non-governmental organizations, going into St. Petersburg in the 1990s, when Vladimir Putin was an aide to Sobchak, and there have been several people who have spoken about this, they said, you know, we were used to going into the mayor's office and we'd have a meeting with one of the aides, because we wanted to get permission to, you know, do a deal or something like that. We'd come in and we'd brief the aide. They said they were always bored. They just, and then they'd get up and they'd leave. But before they left a number on a piece of paper. That was the amount of rubles or dollars that had to go into an envelope. Then they'd come back and you'd give a pitch, and then he'd take the envelope, look at it, and then say, okay, sign the paper and go. So she said she went to a meeting and Vladimir Putin shows up. Never met the guy before. And she said, the first thing is he listened as she talked. She said he sat there and he listened to everything. Every once in a while, he'd interrupt her and ask a question. And the question was relevant, which means he's not just going through the motions of listening. He's actually listening. And he's thinking and he's asking questions. And then he said, I'm going to take a break. But when he left the room, there was no number on the table and she was confused. She didn't know what to do. Because normally at this point, you're reaching your briefcase to pull out the money to put in an envelope, and there's no envelope, there's no number. What does she do? She's in a panic. And the door opens up, Putin comes back, and he asks some follow-on questions. And then he says, look, I like your idea. I think it could be good, but we're not ready for it yet. We need to get up to a certain level that we're not there yet. He said, I've got your contact information. When we get there, I'm going to invite you back in, and maybe then we could talk about doing business. But until then, it was a pleasure to meet you. If you have anything more, don't hesitate to come. And they parted. No money involved. He's incorruptible. That doesn't mean that he didn't cut a deal here or there to survive. Everybody in that environment did. There's not a pure person in Russia during that time. You had to live. But when it came to doing his job, his task, it was pure. And Sobchak recognized that. That's why he got sent up to Yeltsin. Now, in 1999, Boris Yeltsin is on the downslide. He's done. He knows that his health is declining. And he also realizes at this point in time that he's made huge mistakes. Russia is destroyed. And he's looking for who's going to govern. And there's a whole bunch of people surrounding him who wanted that job. Primakov and others. They were just waiting. Who did he turn to? Vladimir Putin. And he said, Putin, I want you to be president. And Putin, you know what his answer was? I'm not ready. I don't want the job. I don't want the job. And he also said, you have to take the job because you're the only one who can do this. And he took the job. Why? Because he was the only person there who cared about Russia more than he cared about himself. That's the whole thing about Vladimir Putin that everybody gets wrong. They think that he was going to be another corrupt Russian politician, that the West could come in. I mean, you know why your people gave him the standing ovation? Because you thought his name was Boris Yeltsin. You thought that what you were listening to is a younger version of Boris Yeltsin who's going to play the game it was always played. And you were anticipating that. But nobody listened to Putin. You know what the first thing Putin did after he was sworn in as president? He got on a helicopter and he flew to Chechnya where they had a war going on. He celebrated New Year's with the frontline soldiers, as a man does, as a leader does. Remember when I talked about leadership? When a guy walks into the room, does he have to order you to follow or do you just naturally follow? Putin walks into a room, people naturally follow him because he's a leader, a leader. He stands for something. He had to repair this broken country, this country that was in collapse. If Vladimir Putin hadn't been selected to be president, and he was selected, he was later elected in March of 2000, but he was selected. If he hadn't been selected, there wouldn't be Russia as we know it today. It would have collapsed, which is what the West always wanted. Vladimir Putin came in and said, no, I'm going to save Russia. But he didn't do it as a dictator. Again, I go back to his style. Remember the lady that came in to talk to him? When Vladimir Putin convenes a council, he listens. He says, okay, I've invited you here. Please talk to me. What do you got? He'll ask questions. Go around, he'll gather the information. He'll take notes. He'll ask follow-on questions. And then he'll sit down and he'll start talking about what he's said. He'll throw ideas out. People come back. He's engaged. That's not how dictators work. Dictators come in and say, I've gathered you here today. Here's my plan. A, B, C, D, E, F, G. Execute it or die. That's what a dictator does. That's what an autocrat does. That's not how Vladimir Putin operates. He listens. And what has he done? He saved Russia. Saved Russia. Look at Russia today. And compare and contrast the Russia of today with the Russia of 1999 when he took over. It is orders of magnitude better. And it is directly attributed to the leadership of Vladimir Putin. And remember, during this time, he hasn't been receiving the willing and able assistance of the West. From the very beginning, when the West realized that Vladimir Putin wasn't going to play the game, wasn't going to become a Boris Yeltsin, we began to interfere. We started buying off opposition politicians, Boris Nemtsov, Navalny, paying them off, the CIA, MI6, paying them off to undermine Vladimir Putin. We used the oligarchs against him. He warned the oligarchs. He came and said, I don't like you. You're corrupt, but you're real. You're here. I can't get rid of you because you're a reality. So here's the deal, oligarchs. You're rich. Keep your riches. I don't want them. You can make more money, but you're going to do it honestly. And the money you make in the future will be taxed. And that tax comes here because I have to pay off the pensioners. I have to pay my soldiers. I have to build infrastructure. I have a country to run. I'm going to run it on the money you're making that I'm going to tax. Be honest, or else I'll take you down. And he said, stay out of politics. There's one, the head of Lukoil.
Yep. Khodorkovsky.
He said, I'm smarter than you, Vlad. I got billions of dollars. You're nothing. You're Boris Yeltsin's little pip boy. So I'm going to run for office. I've got billions. I'm going to win. You know what happened to him? He was destroyed. By whom? Vladimir Putin. Vladimir Putin said, I told you not to get involved in politics. He stripped him of his wealth, put him in jail. And now,
Khodorkovsky.
He's in London right now working for MI6, running various little think tanks and operations against Russia. He always worked for MI6. All the oligarchs work for foreign intelligence. That's how they got their money. That's how they got their wealth. Putin destroyed him, crushed him. But he couldn't crush all the oligarchs because that's where the money is. And Remember, Putin's job wasn't to come in and change Russia overnight. It was to start from the basics, get the basic tax structure down, get the law structure down, get some money in, get the pensions paid, get those old people taken care of, get the soldiers paid so we have a military, get infrastructure up, safe infrastructure, roads, bridges, work slowly, slowly, slowly. And to do that, he had to have an economic engine that worked, and these oligarchs were part of it all the way up until the very end. Putin is free of the oligarchs. Why? Economic sanctions. The greatest gift the West ever gave Vladimir Putin was to sanction the oligarchs, because they did what Putin couldn't do. They destroyed the oligarchs. They seized all their assets, and now the oligarchs, Putin came out after the war, and he went, hey, all you guys out there that stole all these billions, stay in the West. We don't want you anymore. Stay in the West. If you come here, understand that all the money you make stays in Russia from now on, and I'm in charge of you making money. You don't make the rules anymore. I do. This is the new Russia. This is Vladimir Putin. He is the greatest leader in the history of Russia. He saved Russia. He will go down in history as the equivalent of Peter the Great, of Joseph Stalin. Now, people say, Joseph Stalin, why would you can say what you want about Stalin. He saved the Soviet Union. He came in and he is singularly responsible for the industrialization of the Soviet Union, created an economy capable of standing up to Nazi Germany. Did he commit a lot of crimes in the process? Yes. History has judged him. But you have to acknowledge that he was a great leader. Great doesn't mean popular, doesn't mean nice. Great means great. He was a great leader. Vladimir Putin is the greatest Russian leader. He saved Russia. And look where Russia is today, in a position of power and influence that nobody in 1999 thought they'd ever achieve. And it's only because of the leadership of Vladimir Putin.
Very interesting. What Putin also did, he was intensifying the cooperation with Germany. I witnessed that when I was editor-in-chief of Die Welt in Berlin. I'm Swiss, but I worked in Germany. And I saw how Germany and Russia got together. I saw all these parties, you know, with the German industrialists, the Russians were there. It was like a natural symbiosis emerging. And at that time, Putin was regarded critically in the West, even in some German media, but basically there was some, you would say, not a very negative attitude towards him. But somehow along the way, Putin turned into the so-called enemy of the West. If you're reading the newspapers now, they're arguing, even some experts like Timothy Snyder and all these people from Princeton University, etc., they're arguing, they're saying, now we see the true character of Putin, the enemy of the West. He's this Russian imperialist who wants to crush democracy, etc., etc. Could you explain to us how, in the American political perspective of the foreign policy establishment, Putin turned into an enemy? Why did that happen? I think at the beginning, even with the Americans, in the years, the 2000s, there was a chance of cooperation, of friendly coexistence. But why did the Americans suddenly go after Putin and after this German-Russian symbiosis, probably destroying symbolically, even a symbolical act, destroying these Nord Stream pipelines? What road the Americans?
To answer that, I'll start off with a little war story.
Sorry for the long question. It's my English sometimes.
Oh, no, it's a good question. It's a good question. It needs a good answer. So I'm going to start off by saying this. When you asked me to introduce myself, I talked about the fact that I studied Russian language and I studied Russian history in college. And when I was asked to join this inspection organization, the inspection organization was meant to be staffed by the best Russian experts in the U.S. military. Back then, we trained real Russian experts, called them Soviet foreign area officers. To be a foreign area officer, you had to be at least at the rank of major. And you'd be sent to a program where you'd get, you'd study Russian language at the official school in Monterey, California. Great tour, by the way. Spent a year in Monterey, California. Good sun, a lot of fun. But you had to study, learn Russian. Then you went and you got your master's degree in Russian area studies. You could get that in any number of places. A lot of people went to Harvard. A lot of people went to Stanford. High quality education. And then you went to the finishing school, which was in Garmisch, Germany. Today they call it the Marshall Institute, I guess, but after George C. Marshall. But back then it was called the U.S. Army Russia Institute, USARI. And there it's a year or 2 years, depending on, of immersion, total immersion into everything about Russian history, culture. They had a village that they staffed with Russian emigres, and you lived, you went to shop in a Russian store, you spoke Russian, buying things, et cetera. You were immersed in it. And then when that finished, you did what's called a utilization tour. You went out and you advised, you went to the embassy, you did something, and now you came back to the Army. And now we're talking, this is a 3 to 4 to 5 year investment into this person. And now you're in a position to be expert, to advise commands to do jobs, become a defense attaché, et cetera. Real experts. And some of these guys were at the cutting edge of every aspect of U.S.-Soviet relations, arms control, defense related, et cetera. You couldn't, now, this was during the Cold War. If you had asked any of them, how do you feel about the Soviet Union? They say, we don't like the Soviet Union. They're our enemy. But then when you asked them about Russian culture, they could speak in Russian. They could quote you Dostoevsky. They could quote you Lermontov, Pushkin, Tolstoy. They knew Russian culture. They could talk about Bolshoi theater with tears in their eyes because they loved it. They loved Russian culture. They loved the Russian people because they had studied them. They had gotten to know them. They hated the Soviet system. They hated what the Soviet Union was. But the Russian people were in their heart because all of this training led them to become one with them. They were thinking like them, real Russian experts. And that's why we succeeded. We did something in the Soviet Union during to build this inspection facility that was impossible. Nobody thought we could succeed, but because we sent people in who were not just cold warriors, but Russian experts. Mm-hmm. I worked at the time, Jack Matlock was the U.S. ambassador at the time, who was, again, not just a diplomat, a honest-to-God Russian expert. Mm-hmm. Spoke the language, knew the culture. He was going to come out and visit. He was going to do the open house ceremony there, cut the ribbon and the housing unit for the Americans there. And the Soviets said, what does, ambassador's coming out, first time an American ambassador had been to this part of the Soviet Union. What do we do? And so I wrote back to the embassy. I said, the Soviets want to know what Ambassador Matlock, and the answer came back from him, handwritten. He said, hey, this is my first time to the Urmia Republic. I am fascinated with any aspect of their culture. Anything they want to show me, I'll see. I just want to absorb it all. And I went to them. I said, he wants to see everything. Mm-hmm. And they're like, wow. And he came in and they did it all. What a wonderful man, open-minded. The Cold War ends. It collapses. Now, during this time, I was given two classified commendations by the director of the CIA for my work in the Soviet Union. I was a lieutenant. So I was doing some pretty important work. And I was considered to be Soviet, I had grown into the position, and I was recognized, even though I was very young, I was recognized as a Soviet expert, an expert on Russia. In 1993, the last commendation I received from the director of CIA was in 1990. In 1993, I was invited by the CIA to come back and interview for a job in the director of intelligence. They used to have something called SOVA, which is Soviet Affairs, but Soviet Union's gone. So they have this new entity, the Office of Russia, I think it was OREO, Office of Russia and Eurasian Affairs. And I was interviewed by a man who later on became a director of the CIA, Mike Morrell. And he was a Russian area expert at that time. So I interviewed for the job and I thought I'd get it. I mean, I was a Russian expert. Yeah. I had two classified commendations from the CIA director. I thought, and they turned me down. I said, well, why? I said, well, you represent old thinking. We need new thinkers. You're tainted by your Soviet experience.
They wanted the pro-Russian new guys. They thought you were too negative about Russia a cold warrior somehow.
Wrong. I was too positive about Russia.
You were too positive.
Right. What they didn't want a Russian expert. He said that. I don't want what we used to have. We're getting rid of the Russian experts.
You're saying that the U.S. foreign policy, even at that time, was creating after the collapse of the Soviet Union, this new enemy, Russia?
Well, no, they were creating not a new enemy, but a new being, which was a defeated Russia.
Okay.
A Russia that was weak, a Russia that needed our help. So yeah. What they were recruiting are people who were experts in exploiting Russia. Mm-hmm. And you don't have to know Russia to exploit Russia. Mm-hmm. Just have to figure out how to make a dollar here, how to recruit somebody, how to tear something down. They didn't care if I knew, if I quote Pushkin, they didn't care if I knew the history of Russia. They didn't care about anything because none of that was relevant anymore. What they wanted was somebody who could go into Russia and exploit for the benefit. And so this is where you get people like Michael McFaul. Mm-hmm. Michael McFaul came into his political maturity in the 1990s in Russia, exploiting Russia. Fiona Hill, Angela Stent, all of them, exploiters of Russia. They don't know a damn thing about Russia. Oh, yeah, they can speak the language. But just because you can speak the language doesn't mean that you've actually sat down, interface. The only people they interface with are like-minded people, the opposition figure, the people that are helping them exploit Russia. Who is the enemy? Anybody in Russia who stands up and says, I don't want to be exploited. I want Russia to stand on its own two feet. They now become the enemy. Who is the most prominent Russian to stand up and say, I don't want to be exploited? Vladimir Putin. So instead of trying to understand Putin, say, why does Putin do what he does? We immediately said, the only people that would oppose us are autocrats. He is a dictator. He's an autocrat. The people today who are advising people, the Russian experts, aren't experts on Russia at all. Timothy Snyder is not an expert on Russia. Timothy, if you're watching, I've already offered to debate you anytime, any place. Let's do it. But you won't because you're not an expert. Michael McFaul won't debate me. None of them will because they're not experts. They can't talk intelligently about Russia. Jack Matlock, when he was the ambassador, brags about his time in the Bolshoi Theater, his time in the Hermitage, the time seeking out Russian culture, absorbing Russian culture. Michael McFaul, in his book that he writes about it, never once mentions any aspect of Russian culture. It's all about manipulation, 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 manipulation. That's what passes for a Russian expert today. And this is why there's such a disconnect between Vladimir Putin, because even the guys who evaluated him early on, they did it not because they knew Putin. They did it because of artificial expectations of what they wanted Putin to become. They were compelled to morph into what they wanted. They couldn't deal with him by saying, well, why is Vladimir Putin doing what he's doing? Let's dig deep. They said he's opposing us. He must be an autocratic dictator that must be isolated and destroyed. We don't have genuine Russian experts anymore in America.
Do you think, it's very interesting, this streak, this tendency of the United States foreign policy has turned now Putin into a real enemy of the West? Has this Putin, I saw him that way at the time. I saw him as a bridge builder, as an open-minded Russian leader who wanted to cooperate with the West on equal terms. He didn't want to be pushed around, as you described. But look at the Putin today. Have we created an enemy here? And are the perspectives after this war has ended very bleak? Or do you see light at the end of the tunnel that Europe will get a good relationship with Russia back? Or are these days gone for a generation? Is Putin now embittered? Is he now really an enemy of the West? Have we turned him into an enemy?
Well, again, I have never met the man and I've never sat across from him. Mm-hmm. So it's hard for me. You know, to answer a question like that, have we turned him into an embittered man? One would normally want to have experience before he was bitter, sure, and experience after he was bitter, and experience in the transition. So you could say, yes, this is what I saw. Mm-hmm. What I can say is this. I watch every presentation this man gives. First of all, he's one of the smartest leaders out there. Truly a man of phenomenal intellect. I forget who was talking. I think it was the president of Latvia was talking about, you know, we're going to need to have good relations with Russia when this war is over. And he talked about meeting Putin. And, you know, he says, so Putin proclaims himself to be this great Russian leader, da, da, da. So I thought I'd give him a test. And I think he mentioned a book by Lermontov, or a Russian writer. I have to go back and double check on that. And he said, you know, he thought, because it was sort of an obscure passage, obscure work. And he said, Putin sat down without any notes and immediately got into the book got into the character, got into the importance of it, talked about the Russian soul, took it apart. And the guy went, this guy knows everything about Russia. He is the quintessential Russian. He is a Russian leader. Russia's in his soul. Russia oozes from his blood. So we have to respect the fact that Putin is a serious person. Now, is he bitter? I don't know. I watch his presentations. He gets a little angry about being betrayed. I think there is some bitterness towards Angela Merkel. He feels betrayed by her. François Hollande, he feels betrayed. He feels betrayed. He's like the West can't be trusted anymore because of what they've done. But then he talks. This is a very cultured man. And when he speaks of the West, when he speaks of America, when he speaks of Europe, he doesn't do it with hatred in his heart. I've watched his speeches. Is he positive about? No, there's a lot of negatives. And he points out, but when he speaks about them, it's an educated man talking about the potential. And he has said, I have not turned my back on this. The West has turned their back on me. You know, and if the time comes when the West wants to work together, we can do so. As long as Russia is respected, as you said, treated as an equal. But so I don't think there's a bitter Putin. I think actually Putin is going to be the savior of Western Russian relations because he isn't bitter. You know who is bitter? Scholz, Biden, Macron, the entire Western leadership are bitter because they were beat.
It's so interesting what you're saying. I mean, the impression really is there that Putin, as far as I can judge him, as I see it, in his presentations, he seems to be irrational, and the Russians are avoiding extreme language also towards the West, whereas our leaders, they are talking much more emotionally about Russia. They have a much more uncontrolled vocabulary. They use words as weapons in this war. You see a certain hyperbole in the diplomatic language of our politicians, and you see the opposite on the Russian side, probably except Medvedev, who has to overcompensate because they doubted his loyalty to the country. Probably he overdoes it. He gets quoted here. But Putin seems, to me, from the outside, rational, whereas our leaders look emotional. Is that your perception as well?
Yeah, I oversimplify what you say just by saying, I say he's the only adult in the room. And I liken him as a kindergarten teacher, the classroom of unruly children, and he's trying to bring order to them, and all this. Europe is just a bunch of unruly children. Where is the adult in Europe today? Where's the single adult leader in Europe?
Well, we have to ask, where is the adult in the United States?
There isn't one.
It's also some kind of absurd situation. We say in Europe, who is controlling the teleprompter of Joe Biden? I mean, this must be the most powerful man or
person in the world or woman in the world. Yeah, well, I mean, you can ask that question about many people. Who's telling Mitch McConnell, the Republican senator from Kentucky, how to vote? Who's telling Dianne Feinstein, the Democratic senator from California, how to vote? Because neither one of their minds work.
Will we see a change of government in the United States in the next year? Will there be a Republican president again? Probably a president who says it's just not in our interest to continue this lost war in Ukraine, if it still rages on?
Well, I think the Republican Party is in total disarray right now. When the man who's run away with the potential for a Republican nomination is Donald Trump. Man with what, 41 indictments. He might be in jail by the time the election rolls along. And yet, the Republican Party is saying that's the man, the Republican electorate saying that's the man we want by overwhelming numbers. There's nobody that even comes close to those numbers. So the question is, who out of this pack could be plucked out to compete with the Biden machine? Because you said it's not about Biden anymore. It's the machine. There's a machine that's keeping Biden propped up. He's literally.
He's the front man, figurehead.
Yeah, he waddles in and they have to actually stop him talking because he just says really stupid thing. It's very sad, to be honest, if we want to be human about that. And I don't like Joe Biden. Anybody who knows my history knows that he and I go back a long way, and I despise him, and he had disdain for me when I was a weapons inspector. So I don't like the guy, and I don't wish anything good for him, but I'm not a cruel person. And we're looking at a man who is slipping away into dementia. And this is cruel, what's happening to him right now. He really should be pulled out of what he's doing, sent to a quiet retirement place so he could spend the rest of his life not hurting himself and not hurting anybody. But instead, they keep putting him in these situations, and it's not only sad, but it's dangerous, because he is the commander in chief. There's a lot of power that accrues to this position, and his brain's not working. And it's a problem for American democracy, because if his brain's not working, that means the people around him step in where the Constitution doesn't permit them to step in, unless they're going to activate the 25th Amendment. But nobody's talked about doing that. So America's in a very, very tumultuous period in terms of our democracy. Who's going to replace him? I don't think the Republicans have anybody, because what's going to happen is
Trump is not going to make it again.
I don't believe so. I don't believe so. I think his criminal problems are too much. If he survives his criminal problems, he will be the president of the United States, no doubt. But I don't think he will. Joe Biden is done, but he's a figurehead. I think they're going to hold on to Biden long enough to have a Republican candidate identified. And then I think you're going to see Biden be shunted aside and somebody brought in who isn't named Kamala Harris, because she is a disgrace to everything she claims to stand for. I think right now the money's on Gavin Newsom, governor of California. And again, people say there's all problems. Well, there's a problem with every one of the candidates that are out there. None of them are perfect candidates. But Gavin Newsom would have the Democratic machine behind him. The Republicans, if they can't nominate Trump, fall apart, because all these people have been stabbing Trump in the back, or they're unknowns. And I just don't think the Republicans can get the traction necessary to beat. But there is a wild card out there, RFK Jr., Bobby Kennedy Jr. He's the real deal. He's a real politician. He has ideas that are different enough from Democratic and Republican mainstream to separate him, but not too crazy, meaning people say, I buy into that. And if he can gain traction, if the Republican Party disintegrates, and if the Democrats pumped into Gavin Newsom, if it's Bobby Kennedy Jr. versus Gavin Newsom in a general election, Bobby Kennedy Jr. wins. And now we have a change in government. Now we have a government that will be structured differently, will operate differently, will operate more in the lines of the rational thinking that one is normally associates with American leadership. And we'll have a guy who, when he walks into the room, people will follow him because they want to follow him, not because he orders them to follow him. So I think Bobby Kennedy Jr. could be the face, but he has a very long way to go. It's not going to be an easy path, but under normal conditions, I'd say he doesn't stand a chance. But because we have this unique situation where the leading Republican is a criminal who might be in jail, and the leading Democrat is a senile old man whose brain is failing him more and more on a daily basis, there is a window of opportunity for somebody like Bobby Kennedy Jr. to step in and become president.
And it's a miracle that a country like the United States, even with this shattered elite, can still somehow work and march along and even have some success. Probably not so much in the political field, but in the economical field. Let's, for the final question of this very interesting and wide-spanning interview, let's look a bit into the crystal ball. I mean, we have so many insecurities. We have an absurd version of the Cold War coming up. We have the United States, trying to create confrontation with China in a proxy war with Russia. We have a Europe which is non-existent politically, no adults in the room. Probably only Switzerland is the only sane country in Europe, and Hungary, probably Hungary, can be named as well. So a very shaky situation. What's your feeling if you look into the future? Are you optimistic? Are you pessimistic? Do we now enter a field?
I'm looking in my crystal ball.
Now we have to go into your intuition as a very experienced conflict analyst. Your inner voice has to be unleashed now. Are we heading into a dark middle age of conflict, of rage, or do we see just the last turmoil before sanity comes back? What's your view? Are we entering dark times, or are we entering bright times after a shorter period of darkness? How optimistic are you at the moment, or pessimistic?
Yeah, well, let me start by saying this. As bad as the children who govern America and Europe are, I don't view them as suicidal, meaning that and this is an important thing, I don't believe that these are people willing to sacrifice everything for a limited objective of, countering Russia, et cetera. Even though Jan Stoltenberg and others have quantified this Ukrainian-Russian conflict as an existential struggle between Russia and NATO, I don't think that there's a European leader out there right now who's willing to die and sacrifice his or her country for NATO. And this is important, because if I did believe they were willing to die and sacrifice themselves for NATO, then my assessment would be much different. Nor do I believe the American president is willing to sacrifice America or Europe. And so now we've realized that there's a lot of bluff taking place in the West.
Yeah. And now we look. That's the good news, basically. That's the good news.
Well, there's bluff, but again, I bluff so far, but if I'm 6'4", 240 pounds of solid muscle with a big left or right hook and a left jab, I can bluff to a point, but when you call my bluff, I'll still knock you out. But that's not in the United States and Europe today. They're basically the skinny boy on the beach who hides in when he changes his clothes because he's afraid to show people how pathetically skinny he is. There's no strength in Europe today, no military strength. The United States is on the decline. We spend $800-900 billion a year on a defense system, but we can't do anything. I mean, we have nuclear weapons, but that's it. We just spend a lot of money and get very little bang for the buck. How many troops do we have in Europe today? 100,000, but they're not all combat troops, and they're spread out all over the place. These troops would be defeated by the Russians within 2 weeks of any conflict, because there's no sustainability factor. The same thing with any European army. So when I look at this, and I look at the same thing with China, we can't beat China. We know that. Our economy and European economy and Asian economy is so fragile that we can't really get into a economic conflict with China. We paid too heavy a price for our economic conflict with Russia. And so I see a situation here where you have a lot of people bluffing, making noise, posturing.
But especially Putin, on the Western side, especially on the 100% Western side.
100% on the Western. You don't see any posturing from the Russians or the Chinese. They just want to do business. Xi Jinping there's two great leaders in the world today. Vladimir Putin, Xi Jinping. What do they have in common? A, they've been in government for a long time. One of the advantages they have, that Vladimir Putin has over, this is what? He started with Bill Clinton, George Bush, Barack Obama, Donald Trump, Joe Biden. This is his fifth American president. I think he's figured it out by now. And I think Xi Jinping's on his fourth American president. But my point is, these guys have been around for a long time. They've seen the world. Nothing takes them by surprise anymore. They're the adults in the room, and their job is to create a stable world. And we know this because they're working together to create the Shanghai Cooperation Organization. They're working together to create BRICS. They're working to create a Trans-Eurasian Economic Union. They're working about creating global supply chains. They're not building militaries to dominate the world. They're building businesses to create infrastructure around the world that gives them an economic advantage. But hey, in the free market, isn't that what you're always looking for, an economic advantage? The fact that the Russians and the Chinese do it better than us isn't their fault, it's our fault. We should be able to compete, but we don't. So I am optimistic. And here's the other reason why I'm optimistic. Because Vladimir Putin and Xi Jinping know that in order to get maximum benefit to their economy, they need a global market, a global market. They don't want the world fractured into a new Cold War type environment, an us versus them. They need global markets. They need access to the American markets, and they want American to have access to theirs. They want genuine free enterprise. And so if that's their strategic vision, then they're going to behave in a manner that achieves that. They're not going to try and score cheap political points or geopolitical points by getting, you know, a Brzezinski-like chess move over here and there and there and there. That's not their game. Their game is stability, multipolarity, listening to other nations, working together as a global team. That's their approach. I've oversimplified it, and I know there's going to be people out there say Scott Ritter smokes dope on a daily business and he's hallucinating when he talks about this. It's more complicated than that, but from a broad picture, making this broad assessment, that's the vision I see of the Chinese and Russians working together. And I look at America and Europe, I see bitter old men and women who are bluffing, though, because at the end of the day, when you take off their clothes, they don't have the buff bodies anymore. They're sort of pathetic. They're old, they're fat, they're skinny, and they're not going to be able to challenge the Chinese. Instead, what's going to happen is I believe that Russia and China will give them space to grow to where they need to grow and to be part of the global community. And I believe that in 50 years, 100 years, you're going to see a Europe and an America integrated into the global network in a much more constructive manner than we are now. They're not going to be subordinated to Russia or China, but they're going to be the equals of Russia and China.
As a Swiss, as a neutral Swiss, I can say from an independent view that I totally share your optimistic view. And I have talked recently to my former philosophy professor. He's a German. He's now 96 years old. And I asked him the same question. And he says, no, come on, I'm very optimistic because the Russians and the Chinese, they went through hell in the last 150 years. And this historical experience is so deeply ingrained in these peoples, and they have seen the benefits of globalization, of international cooperation, and they see the fruits of it. Whereas we in the West, we are totally decadent. We take it for granted. We are embarking in this on this crazy woke philosophy, thinking about gender toilets and, you know, how to destroy our language and everything. These are typical signs of late Roman decadence. And to take your point here to a provocative condensation, one could say Russia will probably get arrested if I say that, but Russia and China are helping the decadent West to refine itself and to redetect its values and the value of international cooperation on the giving up this arrogance, this attitude that we can control the world, that we can bully the world, and that we can tell great civilizations what they are up to. So reason to be optimistic.
I share your optimism and I agree. Look, like I said, I love my country. I love it deeply. I love the potential of America. I don't disrespect Russian culture. I don't disrespect Chinese culture. And I definitely don't disrespect their history. But I do believe that America has the potential to be one of the great nations in the world.
We stand definitely one of the very great nations of the world.
But I mean, we can be great not because we bully people. We can be great because we lead. We lead from a principled standpoint. Not that we sit tell people what they have to do. You know, democracies aren't created by me forcing you to be democratic. Democracies are created by me setting an example and you emulating it based upon your own needs. And then I respect the fact that what you have is different from me, but it works for you. And that's America should be that nation. We should be the nation that strives to make ourselves the best possible nation in the world based upon the realities of our situation. We have to stop being a nation which has a small percentage of the world's population, but consumes so much of the world's resources. That's an unequal thing. We have to learn to live within our means and to be the best we can within those means, and then to work with the world to make everybody better. And if we do that, look, we're a rich nation. We have wonderful wealth. We have a population that's stunning. Anybody who's been to America, throw away the politics, get out of the inner city and travel America and meet the American people. They're the best damn people in the world. They're hearts of gold. They work hard. They will help you. They believe in things, but they've lost their way because their politicians have lost their way. If we can get political leadership to fall back in on the basics America is a great country. People would love to be friends with America. There was a time when people wanted to be friends with America, and I'm hopeful there's a time when people want to be friends with us as well.
In addition to the Americans, one great strength of your country is your constitution, is your philosophy, which is very similar, by the way, as the Swiss philosophy. We are also based on an idea of the idea of democracy, not of some kind of ethnicity or, national myths or whatever, in a racist way or whatever. We have a constitution based on principles and which was modeled also after the American Constitution. I cannot finish this conversation without a word on Switzerland, of course, Scott. How do you assess Switzerland's role in the world, especially in this conflict, Switzerland's neutrality? We have a huge discourse in this country, in our parliament. I'm now in Bern, just some 100, 200 meters next to me. There is our parliament. There is a huge fight. There are some people in Switzerland saying Switzerland has to join NATO. Switzerland has to deliver weapons to the Ukraine. And then there are the others, such as me, who are saying, no, Switzerland has to stay neutral as a small country. What's your view on Switzerland?
Well, I can say this. I was actually just in Switzerland earlier this month. I was invited by an organization, Mut zur Ethik. I attended a conference outside of Zurich. I wasn't there for long, 4 days, I think, total. But it was an immersive experience, and this issue of, I was educated on the concept of Swiss direct democracy, which I think is fantastic, and also on this fight, the struggle in Switzerland over Swiss neutrality and the role of that. What I can say is this, and I hope I don't insult anybody too much, but if the truth insults, then the truth insults. I don't care. Switzerland does not have a military that's capable of changing the balance of power in Europe. So any notion of Switzerland joining NATO, for what reason? To make Switzerland stronger? Why does Switzerland need to be stronger? To help Europe be stronger? Switzerland can't do that. You don't have a military capable of doing that. So I'm struggling to find out why a Swiss citizen would want to demean Switzerland, to diminish Switzerland by joining NATO, because it will only make you weaker. It will only expose the fact that you're a small, landlocked nation with limited resources, and you will become totally dependent upon everybody else in NATO, because you now have defined yourself as part of a system that you don't belong in. You never did belong in, and you never will belong in. I'm confused by that. Two, sell munitions. I mean, what, you make 20 millimeter cannon ammunition, 40 millimeter cannon ammunition that's used in Bofors guns that are equipped certain things, and they've provided those to the Ukrainians, but you're not allowing them to resell the ammunition, all that. Just let me help Switzerland on this one. No one cares about your ammunition. It's not going to make any difference at all. It's not. The Russians don't wake up every morning screaming, oh my God, here comes the Swiss ammunition.
Swiss tanks.
Swiss tanks, Swiss airplane, whatever. There's nothing you have that can change the outcome of the battle in Ukraine, and nothing you have that can change the balance of power in Europe. Why delude yourself? Because this is delusion. This is basically, you need to go talk to a psychologist or a psychiatrist, find out why you feel this need to be bigger than what you are. Because you're nothing but a small, landlocked European country. What gives you your relevance is neutrality. Neutrality makes Switzerland a great nation, not just a great nation, one of the greatest nations. Let me explain this to the Swiss, how important this is. Right now in Korea, in the Korean Peninsula, there's a demilitarized zone. You have the Americans leading the South Koreans, and we still have to call it the United Nations forces, to the south. You have the North Koreans backed up by the Chinese and to a lesser extent the Russians to the north. And there's a real potential of conflict. There's two armies facing off together. In the DMZ, there's 10 men, a unit of 10 men. Five of them are Swedish, five of them are Swiss, neutral countries. And they get to travel everywhere, and they're trusted by everybody because they don't, they're not prejudiced by being part of this bloc or that bloc. And they accomplish so much in deconfliction. If there's a problem, they make peace possible. Five men from Switzerland have more impact on global security in the Korean Peninsula than a million men on either side of the border. Five Swiss men are more important than a million men on each side of the border. That's how important you are. And why you don't appreciate that, I don't know. You know, the Intermediate Nuclear Forces Treaty that I was part of, it was a very complicated negotiation between the United States and the Soviet Union. And you know where those negotiations took place? In Geneva. Why? Because it's neutral ground. Because we felt safe to come in there, they felt safe to come in there, and through this neutral space, Sweden saved the world. I don't mean to be a little overblowing here, guys. Had the Intermediate Nuclear Forces Treaty not been signed, we'd all be dead today because there would have been a thermonuclear war. Go research the destabilizing aspects of the SS-20 missile that the Soviets deployed in the 70s, leading to the deployment of Pershing 2 missiles and ground-launched cruise missiles by the United States and Europe, and how we had now lessened the time to strike Moscow to under 12 minutes, meaning there's no reaction time in case of a mistake, and there were mistakes. The world would have ended. You know why the world is surviving today? Not just because of me as an inspector, although I insist that people shake my hand and buy me a beer and thank me for them being alive today, but be that as it may, I wouldn't have been able to do my job if it weren't for Geneva, this neutral space. Switzerland saved the world and has the potential of saving the world again. You're a small country. You have limited resources. You have no military worthy of the name, no insult to those brave Swiss men who carry their guns home. Okay, if I invade your country, I'm sure you'll die gloriously. But if it's the Marines invade your country, we will kill you all because we're professional murderers. You're Swiss citizens. There's a difference. You don't want to become professional murderers. That's the last thing you want to be. You want to be good Swiss citizens, and you want to be neutral parties so that everybody trusts you and relies upon you to save the world. We are going to need to be saved from people like me, from people like the Russian equivalent of me, who all we want to do is close with and destroy the enemy through firepower and maneuver. That's all I think about. I think about killing the enemy. You should be thinking about peace. You should be thinking about how you can get this rabid wolf named Scott Ritter to sit down with a rabid wolf, a Russian name, at a table where we can stop talking about killing each other and start talking about peaceful coexistence. Mm-hmm. That is Switzerland's role. And you can only do that if you're neutral. And I hope the Swiss people understand that. What makes you the greatest nation in the world is your neutrality. And when you lose that, you become one of the least significant nations in the world.
Scott Ritter, thank you very much with your great words, which will echo for eternity in our Swiss parliament. I hope it has been a great privilege to have this candid conversation about so many important topics. Thank you very much for your time. Thank you very much for your wisdom, your insight. And we have seen today a patriotic American who considers his duty to pull up the mirror and also to be critical towards the political developments in his own country. Many thanks for this conversation.
Thanks for having me. It was a pleasure.